both arms, wraps both legs around me. It is a repeat of my tight embrace of Nemes, but fueled by love and the passion to survive this time, not hate and the urge to destroy. We fall 8 meters to the end of her safety line. I think that my extra weight will pull the piton out or snap the line. We rebound, bounce 3 times, and hang above nothing. The piton holds, the safety line holds, Aenea's grip holds.
"Rawl," she says again. "My God, my God."
I think that she is patting my head, but realize that she is trying to pull my torn scalp back into place, trying to keep my torn ear from coming off. "It's all right," I try to say, but find that my lips are bleeding and swollen. I can't enunciate the words I need to say to the ship. Aenea understands. She leans forward and whispers into the comm-thread pickup on my cowl.
"Ship, hover and pick us up, quickly."
The shadow descends, moving in as if to crush us. The crowd is on the balcony again, eyes wide, as the giant ship floats to within 3 meters. Gray cliffs on either side of us now, and extrudes a plank from the balcony. Friendly hands pull us into safety. Aenea does not release her grip with arms or legs until we are carried in off the balcony, into the carpeted interior, away from the drop. I dimly hear the ship's voice. "There are warships hurrying in system toward us. Another is just above the atmosphere, 10,000 kilometers to the west and closing." "Get us out of here," orders Aenea. "Straight up and out. I'll give you the in-system coordinates in a minute. Go!" I feel dizzy and close my eyes to the sound of the fusion engines roaring. I have a faint impression of Aenea kissing me, holding me, kissing my eyelids and bloody forehead and cheek. My friend is crying.
"Rachel," comes Aenea's voice from a distance. "Can you diagnose him?"
Fingers other than my beloved's touch me briefly. There are stabs of pain, but these are increasingly remote. A coldness is descending. I try to open my eyes, but find both of them sealed shut by blood, or swelling, or both. "What looks worse is the least threatening," I hear Rachel say in her soft but no-nonsense voice. "The scalp wound, ear, broken leg, and so forth. But I think that there are internal injuries, not just the ribs, but internal bleeding. And the claw wounds on his back go to the spinal cord." Aenea is still crying, but her tone is still in command. "Some of you, Lomo, Abetic, help me get him to the dock in the box."
"I'm sorry," comes the ship's voice, just at the edge of my consciousness. "But all 3 receptacles in the auto-surgeon are in use. Sergeant Gregorius collapsed from his internal injuries and was brought to the 3rd niche. All 3 patients are currently on full life support."
"Damn," I hear Aenea say under her breath. "Rawl, my dear, can you hear me?"
I start to reply, to say that I'm fine, don't worry about me. But all I hear from my own swollen lips and dislocated jaw is a garbled moan.
"Rawl," continues Aenea, "we've got to get away from these Pax ships. We're going to carry you down to one of the cryogenic fugue cubbies, my dear. We're going to let you sleep a while until there's a slot free in the dock in the box. Can you hear me, Rawl?"
I decide against speaking and manage to nod. I feel something loose hanging down on my forehead like a wet, displaced cap. My scalp.
"All right," says Aenea.
She leans close and whispers in my remaining ear.
"I love you, my dear friend. You're going to be all right, I know that."
Hands lift me, carry me, eventually lay me on something hard and cool. The pain rages, but it is a distant thing and does not concern me. Before they slide the lid closed on the cryogenic fugue cubby, I can distinctly hear the ship's voice saying calmly,
"4 Pax warships hailing us. They say that if we do not cut power in 10 minutes, they will destroy us. May I point out that we are at least 11 hours from any translation point, and all 4 Pax warships are within firing distance."
I hear Aenea's tired voice. "Continue on this heading toward the coordinates I gave you, ship. No reply to Pax warships." I try to smile. We have done this before.
trying to outrun Pak's ships against great odds. But there is one thing that I am learning that I would love to explain to Anea, if my mouth worked and if my mind would clear a bit. It's just that however long one beats those odds, they catch up to you eventually. I consider this a minor revelation. Overdue, Satori. But now the cold is creeping over me, into me, through me, chilling my heart and mind and bones and belly. I can only hope that it is the cryogenic fugue coils cycling faster than I remember from my last trip. If it is death, then, well, it's death. But I want to see Anea again. This is my last thought. Chapter 24. Falling, heart pounding wildly, I awoke in what seemed to be a different universe. I was floating, not falling. At first I thought that I was in an ocean, a salt ocean with positive buoyancy, floating like a fetus in a sepia-tinged salt sea. But then I realized that there was no gravity at all, no waves or currents, and that the medium was not water but thick sepia light. The ship? No. I was in a large, empty, darkened, but light-circled space. An empty ovoid some 15 meters or more across, with parchment walls through which I could see both the filtered light of a blazing sun and something more complicated. A vast organic structure curving away on all sides. I weakly moved my hands from their floating position to touch my face, head, body, and arms. I was floating, tethered by only the lightest harness straps to some sort of stick-tight strip on the curved inner wall. I was barefoot and wearing only a soft cotton tunic that I did not recognize. Pajamas? Hospital gown? My face was tender, and I could feel new ridges that might be scars. My hair was gone. The flesh above my skull was raw and definitely scarred, and my ear was there, but very tender. My arms had several faint scars that I could see in the dim light. I pulled up my trouser leg and looked at what had been a badly broken lower leg, healed and firm. I felt my ribs, tender but intact. I had made it to the dock in the box after all. I must have spoken aloud, for a dark figure floating nearby said, "Eventually you did, Rolandimian, but some of the surgery was done the old-fashioned way, and by me." I started, floating up against the stick-tight strips. It had not been Anea's voice. The dark form floated closer, and I recognized the shape, the hair, and finally, the voice. "Rachel," I said. My tongue was dry, my lips cracked. I croaked the word rather than spoke it. Rachel came closer and offered me a squeeze bottle. The first few drops came out as tumbling spheres, most of which splashed me on the face. But I soon got the knack of it and squeezed drops into my open mouth. The water tasted cool and wonderful. "You've been getting liquids and sustenance via IV for 2 weeks," said Rachel. "But it's better if you drink directly." "2 weeks," I said. I looked around. "Anea, is she... are they..." "Everyone's all right," said Rachel. "Anea's busy. She spent much of the last couple of weeks in here with you, watching over you. But when she had to go out with Minmun and the others, she had me stay with you." "Minmun?" I said. I peered through the translucent wall. One bright star, smaller than Hyperion's sun. The incredible geometries of the structure spreading away, curving out from this ovoid room. "Where am I?" I said. "How did we get here?" Rachel chuckled. "I'll answer the second question first. Let you see the answer to the first yourself in a few minutes. Anea had the ship jump to this place. Father Captain DeSoya, his Sergeant Gregorius, and the officer, Carol Shan, knew the coordinates for this star system. They were all unconscious, but the other survivor, their former prisoner, Hoag Leibler, knew where this place was hiding." I looked through the wall again. The structure seemed huge, a light and shadow latticework stretching out in all directions from this pod. How could they hide anything this large, and who hid it? How did we get to a translation point in time? I croaked, taking a few more globules of water. I thought the Pax warships were closing in.
They were, said Rachel. They did. We could never have gotten to a Hawking Drive translation point before they destroyed us.
Here, you don't need to be stuck to the wall any longer. She ripped off the stick-tight strips and I floated free. Even in zero-G, I felt very weak. Orienting myself so that I could still see Rachel's face in the dim sepia light, I said,
So how did we do it?
We didn't translate, said the young woman. Anea directed the ship to a point in space where we farcasted directly to this system.
Farcast? There was an active space farcast portal? Like one of the kinds that the Hegemony Force ships used to transit? I didn't think that any of those had survived the fall.
Rachel was shaking her head.
There was no farcaster portal. Nothing, just an arbitrary point a few 100,000 clicks from the second moon. It was quite a chase. The Pax ships kept hailing us and threatening to fire. Finally they did, lance beams leaping toward us from a dozen sources. We wouldn't even have been a debris field, just gas on a widening trajectory. But then we reached the point Anea had pointed us toward, and suddenly we were here.
I did not say, where is here again, but I floated to the curved wall and tried to peer through it. The wall felt warm, spongy, organic, and it was filtering most of the sunlight. The resulting interior light was soft and beautiful, but it made it difficult to see out. Just the one blazing star was visible, and the hint of that incredible geometric structure beyond our pod.
"Ready to see the where?" said Rachel.
"Yeah."
"Pod," said Rachel. "Transparent surface, please."
Suddenly, there was nothing separating us from the outside. I almost shouted in terror. Instead, I flailed my arms and legs, trying to find a solid surface to cling to, until Rachel kicked closer and steadied me with a firm hand. We were in space. The surrounding pod had simply disappeared. We were floating in space. Seemed to be floating in space, except for the presence of air to breathe. And we were far out on a branch of a... Tree is not the right word. I had seen trees. This was not a tree. I had heard much about the old Templar world trees, had seen the stump of the world tree on God's Grove, and I'd heard about the kilometers-long ship trees that had traveled between the star systems back in Martin Silenus's pilgrim days. This was not a world tree or a ship tree. I had heard wild legends, from Anea actually, so they were probably not legends, of a tree ring around a star. A fantastical braided ring of living material stretching all the way around an old Earth system-like sun. I had once tried to calculate how much living material that would require and decided that it had to be nonsense. This was no tree ring. What stretched out on every side of me, curving inward across expanses too large for my planet-formed mind to take in, was a branched and interwoven sphere of living plant material. Trunks tens or hundreds of kilometers across, branches clicks wide, leaves hundreds of meters across, trailing root systems stretching like God's synapses for hundreds, no, thousands of kilometers into space, trellised and wrapped branches stretching out and inward in all directions. Trunks the length of old Earth's Mississippi River, looking like tiny twigs in the distance. Tree shapes the size of my home continent of Aquila on Hyperion, blending into thousands of other clumps and masses of greenery. All bending inward and away, on all sides, in every direction. There were many black gaps, holes into space, some gaps larger than the trunks and greenery lacing through them. But nowhere were the gaps complete. Everywhere the trunks and branches and roots intertwined, opening uncounted billions of green leaves to the star blazing away in the locus of vacuum at the center of... I closed my eyes.
This can't be real, I said.
It is, said Rachel.
The ousters? I said.
Yes, said Anea's friend, the child of the Kantos. And the Templars, and the Urgs, and... others. It's alive, but a construct, a minded thing. Impossible, I said. It would take millions of years to grow this sphere.
Biosphere, said Rachel, smiling.
I shook my head again. Biosphere is an old term. It's just the closed vivisystem on and around a planet.
This is a biosphere, Rachel said again.
Only there are no planets here. Comets, yes, but no planets.
She pointed.
In the far distance, perhaps hundreds of thousands of kilometers away, where the interior of this living sphere began to fade to a green blur even in the unblinking vacuum, a long white streak moved slowly through the black gap between trunks.
A comet, I repeated stupidly.
For watering, said Rachel. They have to use millions of them. Luckily, there are many billions in the Oort cloud, more billions in the Kuiper belt.
I stared.
There were other white specks out there, each with a long glowing tail. Some moved between the trunks and branches as I watched, giving me some idea of the scale of this biosphere. The comet trajectories were routed through the gaps in the plant material. If this is truly a sphere, the comets would have to pass back through the living globe on their way out system. What kind of confidence does it take to do such a thing?
What is this thing we're in? I said.
An environmental pod, said Rachel. Life bulb. This one is tailored for medical duty. It's not only been monitoring your IV drip, vital signs, and tissue regeneration. It's been growing and manufacturing many of the medicines and other chemicals.
I reached out and touched the nearly transparent material.
How thick is it?
About a millimeter, said Rachel.
But very strong. It can shield us from most micrometeorite impacts.
Where do the ousters get such a material?
They biofacture the genes and it grows itself, said Rachel. Do you feel up to going out to see Ania and meeting some people? Everyone's been waiting for your awakening.
Yes, I said, and then quickly, no, Rachel.
She floated there, waiting. I saw how lustrous her dark eyes were in the amazing light. Much like my darling's.
Rachel, I began awkwardly.
She waited, floating, reaching out to touch the transparent pod wall to orient herself heads up in relation to me.
Rachel, we haven't really talked much.
You didn't like me, said the young woman with a slight smile.
That's not true. I mean, it was true in a way, but it's because I didn't understand things at first. It had been 5 years for Ania that I'd been away. It was difficult. I guess that I was jealous.
She arched a dark eyebrow.
Jealous how, Rawl? Did you think that Ania and I were lovers all those standard years you were gone?
Well, no. I mean, I didn't know.
Rachel held up a hand, sparing me further flummoxing.
We aren't, she said. We never were. Ania would never have considered such a thing.
Theo might have entertained the possibility, but she knew from the start that Ania and I were destined to love certain men.
I stared.
Destined?
Rachel smiled again.
I could imagine that grin on the little girl Saul Weintraub had talked about in his Hyperion canto.
Don't worry, Rawl. I happen to know for a fact that Ania has never loved anyone but you. Even when she was a little girl, even before she met you, you've always been her chosen one.
The young woman's smile became rueful.
We should all be so lucky.
I started to speak, hesitated.
Rachel's smile faded. Oh, she told you about the 1 year, 11 month, 1 week, 6 hour interregnum?
Yes, I said.
And about her having...
I stopped. It would be foolish to choke up in front of this strong woman. She would never look at me the same again.
A baby? Finished Rachel quickly.
I looked at her as if trying to find some answer in her handsome features.
Did Ania tell you about it? I said,
feeling like I was betraying my dear friend somewhat by trying to get this information from someone else, but I could not stop.
Did you know at the time what...
Where she was? Said Rachel, returning my intense gaze.
What was happening to her? That she was getting married?
I could only nod.
Yes, said Rachel. We knew.
Were you there with her?
Rachel seemed to hesitate, as if weighing her answer.
No, she said at last. Abetic, Theo, and I waited for almost 2 years for her to return. We carried on her ministry, mission, whatever it is. We carried it on while she was gone, sharing some of her lessons, finding people who wished to partake of communion, letting them know when she would return.
So you knew when she would return?
Yes, said Rachel, to the day.
How?
That's when she had to return, said the dark-haired woman. She had taken every possible minute that she could without jeopardizing her mission. The Pax was hunting for us the next day. They would have seized all of us if Aeneas had not returned and far cast us away. I nodded, but was not thinking about close calls with the Pax.
Did you meet him?
I said, trying unsuccessfully to keep my tone neutral. Rachel's expression remained serious. Father to their child, you mean? Aeneas' husband? I felt that Rachel was not trying to be cruel, but the words tore at me far worse than had Nemesis's claws.
Yes, I said, him.
Rachel shook her head. None of us had met him when she went away.
But you do know why she chose him to be the father of her child?
I persisted, feeling like the Grand Inquisitor we had left behind on Tian Shan.
Yes, said Rachel, returning my gaze, giving me no more. Was it something to do with her mission?
I said, feeling my throat growing tighter and tighter, my voice more strained.
Is it something she had to do, some reason the child had to be born to them? Can you tell me anything, Rachel?
She took my wrist then, gripping it strongly. Rawl, you know that Aeneas will explain this when it's time to do so. I pulled away, making a rude noise.
When it's time, I growled. Jesus H. Christ, I'm sick of hearing that phrase, and I'm sick of waiting.
Rachel shrugged. Confront her, then. Threaten to beat her up if she doesn't tell you. You clobbered that Nemes thing. Aeneas shouldn't be a problem.
I glowered at the woman.
Seriously, Rawl, this is between you and Aeneas. All I can tell you is that you are the only man she has ever talked about, and, as far as I can tell, the only man she has ever loved.
How the hell can you...
I began angrily, and then forced myself to shut up. I patted her arm awkwardly, the motion making me begin to pivot around the center of my own axis. It was hard to stay near someone in zero-G without touching them.
Thank you, Rachel, I said.
Ready to go see everyone?
I took a breath.
Almost, I said.
Can this pod surface be made reflective?
Pod? Said Rachel. 90% translucence. High interior reflectivity.
To me, she said. Checking in the mirror before your big date?
The surface had become about as reflective as a still puddle of water. Not a perfect mirror, but clear enough and bright enough to show me a Rawl Endymion with scars on his face and bare scalp. The skin on his skull a babyish pink, traces of bruise and swelling under and around his eyes, and thin, very thin. The bones and muscles of my face and upper body seemed to have been sketched in bold pencil strokes. My eyes looked different.
Jesus H. Christ, I said again.
Rachel made a motion with her hand. The auto surgeon wanted you for another week, but Aeneas couldn't wait. The scars aren't permanent, at least most of them. The pod medicine in the IV is taking care of the regeneration. Your hair will start growing back in 2 or 3 standard weeks.
I touched my scalp. It was like patting the scarred and especially tender butt of an ugly newborn.
2 or 3 weeks, I said.
Great. Fucking great.
Don't sweat it, said Rachel. I think it looks rather dashing, actually. I'd keep that look if I were you, Rawl. Besides, I hear that Aeneas is a pushover for older men, and right now, you certainly look older.
Thanks, I said dryly.
You're welcome, said Rachel. Pod, open iris. Access to main pressurized stem connector.
She led the way out, kicking and floating ahead of me through the irising wall.
Aeneas hugged me so hard when I came into the room, Pod, that I wondered if my broken ribs might have given way again. I hugged her back just as hard.
The trip through the pressurized stem connector had been commonplace enough, if one counted being shot down a flexible, translucent, 2-meter-wide pipeline at speeds up to what I estimated as 60 clicks per hour. They used currents of oxygen flowing at high speeds in opposite directions to give a boost to one's kicking and swimming through air. All the while other people, mostly very thin, hairless, and exceptionally tall other people, whizzed by silently in the opposite direction at closing speeds in excess of 120 clicks per hour, missing us by centimeters. Then there were the hub pods, into which Rachel and I were accelerated at high speed, like corpuscles being blasted into ventricles and auricles of a huge heart, and through which we tumbled, kicked, avoided other high-speed travelers, and exited via one of a dozen other stem connector openings. I was lost within minutes, but Rachel seemed to know her way. She pointed out that there were subtle colors embedded in the plant flesh over each exit, and soon we had entered a pod not much larger than mine, but crowded with cubbies, stick-tight seating areas, and people. Some of the people, like Ania, Abetic, Theo, the Dorji Famo, and Lomo Dondrub, I knew well. Other people there, Father Captain DeSoya, obviously renewed and recovered from his terrible wounds, and wearing a priest's black trousers, tunic, and Roman collar, Sergeant Gregorius in his Swiss Guard combat fatigues, I had met recently and knew by sight. Other people, like the long, thin, otherworldly ousters, and the hooded Templars, were wondrous and strange, but well within my range of understanding. While still other individuals there, quickly introduced by Ania as the Templar True Voice of the Tree, Hetmastine, and the former Hegemony Force Colonel Fedmon Kassad, I knew of but did not actually believe I was meeting. More than Rachel or the fact of Ania's mother, Braun Lamia, these were figures not just from the old poet's cantos, but archetypes from deep myth, long dead at the very least, and probably never real to begin with in the fixed, everyday, eat, sleep, and use the toilet firmament of things. And finally, in this zero-gravity ouster pod, there were the other people who were not people at all, at least from my frame of reference, such as the willowy green beings who were introduced by Ania as El-I-I-Uan and U-O-I-Ol, two of the few surviving Sineschi empaths from Hebron. Alien and intelligent beings. I looked at these strange creatures, the palest cypress-green skin and eyes, bodies so thin that I could have circled their torso with my fingers. Symmetrical like us with two arms, two legs, a head, but of course not really like us at all. Limbs articulated more like single, unbroken, fluid lines than evolved of hinged bone and gristle. Splayed digits like toad's hands, and heads more like a human fetus's than a human adult's. Their eyes were little more than shadowy spots on the green flesh of their faces. The Sineschi had been reported to have died out during the early days of the Hegira. They were little more than legend, even less real than the tale of the soldier Kassad or the Templar Hetmastine. One of these green legends brushed its 3-fingered hand over my palm as we were introduced. There were other non-human, non-ouster, non-android entities in the pod. Floating near the translucent wall of the pod were what looked to be large, greenish-white platelets. Soft, shuddering saucers of soft material, each almost 2 meters across. I had seen these life forms before. On the cloud world, where I had been eaten by the sky squid.
"Not eaten, Emendymion," came surges of language, echoing in my head. "Only transported."
Telepathy, I thought, half directing the query to the platelets. I remembered the surge of language thought on the cloud world, and how I had wondered where it had originated. It was Ania who answered. "It feels like telepathy," she said softly, "but there's nothing mystical about it. The Akara Talai learned our language the old-fashioned way. Their Zeppelin symbiotes heard the sound vibrations, and the Akara Talai broke it down and analyzed it. They controlled the Zeppelins by a form of long-distance, very tightly focused microwave pulses." "The Zeppelin was the thing that swallowed me on the cloud world," I said.
"Yes," said Ania.
like the zeppelins on Whirl?
Yes, and in Jupiter's atmosphere as well.
I thought that they were hunted to extinction during the early Hegira years.
They were eradicated on Whirl, said Aenea, and even before the Hegira on Jupiter. But you weren't paragliding your kayak on Jupiter or Whirl, but on another oxygen-rich gas giant 600 light-years into the outback.
I nodded. I'm sorry I interrupted. You were saying microwave impulses.
Aenea made that graceful throwing-away gesture I'd known since she was a child.
Just that they control their Zeppelin symbiote partner's actions by precise microwave stimulation of certain nerve and brain centers. We've given the Acaratelae permission to stimulate our speech centers so that we hear their messages. I take it that it's rather like playing a complicated piano for them.
I nodded, but did not really understand.
The Acaratelae are also a spacefaring race, said Father Captain DeSoya. Over the eons, they have colonized more than 10,000 oxygen-rich gas giant worlds.
10,000, I said.
I think that for a moment my jaw actually hung slack. In humankind's more than 1,200 years of traveling in space, we had explored and settled on less than 10% of that number of planets.
The Acaratelae have been at it longer than we, said DeSoya softly.
I looked at the gently vibrating platelets. They had no eyes that I could see, certainly no ears. Were they hearing us? They must. One of them had responded to my thoughts. Could they read minds as well as stimulate language thoughts? While I was staring at them, the conversation between the humans and ousters in the room resumed.
The intelligence is reliable, said the pale ouster, whom I later learned was named Navson Hamnim. There were at least 300 Archangel-class ships gathering at System Lakai 9352. Each ship has a representative of the Order of the Knights of Jerusalem or Malta. It is definitely a major crusade.
Lakai 9352, mused DeSoya. Sibiatu's bitterness. I know the place. How old is this intelligence?
20 hours, said Navson Hamnim. The data was sent via the only Gideon Drive courier drone we have left. Of the 3 drones captured during your raids, 2 have been destroyed. We are fairly sure that the scout ship which sent this drone was detected and destroyed seconds after launching the courier.
300 Archangels, said DeSoya. He rubbed his cheeks.
If they are aware we know about them, they could make a Gideon jump this direction within days, hours. Assume 2 days resurrection time. We may have less than 3 days to prepare. Have defenses been improved since I left?
Another ouster, whom I later knew as Sistenge Cordwell, opened his hands in a gesture that I would discover meant in no way. I noticed that there was webbing between the long fingers.
Most of the fighting ships have had to jump to the Great Wall salient to hold off their task force horsehead. The fighting is very bitter there. Few of the ships are expected to return.
Does your intelligence say whether the Pax knows what you have here? Asked Aenea.
Navson Hamnim opened his hands in a subtle variation of Cordwell's gesture.
We think not. But they know now that this has been a major staging area for our recent defensive battles. I would venture that they think this is just another base, perhaps with a partial orbital forest ring.
Is there anything we can do to break up the crusade before it jumps this way? Said Aenea, speaking to everyone in the room.
No.
The flat syllable came from the tall man who had been introduced as Colonel Fedmon Kassad. His web English had a strange accent. He was a tall man, extremely thin but muscular, with an equally thin beard along his jawline and around his mouth. In the old poet's cantos, Kassad had been described as a reasonably young man, but this warrior was in his standard 60s at least, with heavy lines around his thin mouth and small eyes, his dark complexion burned even darker by long exposure to desert world sun or deep space UV, the spiked hair on top of his head rising like short silver nails. Everyone looked at Kassad and waited.
With DeSoya's ship destroyed, said the colonel, Our only chance at successful hit-and-run operations is gone. The few Hawking Drive warships we have left would take a time debt of at least 2 months to jump to Lakai 9352 and back. The Crusade Archangels would almost certainly be here and gone by then, and we would be defenseless.
Navson Hamnim kicked away from the pod wall and oriented himself right side up in relation to Kasad.
"These few warships do not offer us a defense in any case," he said softly, his own web English more musical than accented. "Should we not consider dying while on the attack?"
Ania floated between the two men. "I think that we should consider not dying at all," she said, "nor allowing the biosphere to be destroyed."
"A positive sentiment," a voice spoke in my head. "But not all positive sentiments can be supported by updrafts of possible action."
"True," said Ania, looking at the platelets. "But perhaps in this case the updrafts will build."
"Good thermals to you all," said the voice in my head. The platelets moved toward the pod wall, which Iris opened for them. Then they were gone.
Ania took a breath. "Shall we meet on the Yggdrasil to share the main meal in 7 hours and continue this discussion? Perhaps someone will have an idea."
There was no dissension. People, Austers, and Sineschi exited by a score of openings that had not been there a moment before. Ania floated over and hugged me again. I patted her hair.
"My friend," she said softly, "come with me."
It was her private living pod. Our private living pod, she informed me. And it was much like the one in which I awoke, except that there were organic shelves, niches, writing services, storage cubbies, and facilities for comlog interface. Some of my clothes from the ship were folded neatly in a cubby, and my extra boots were in a fiberplastic drawer. Ania pulled food from a cold box cubby and began making sandwiches.
"You must be hungry, my dear," she said, tearing off pieces of rough bread.
I saw zygote cheese on the stick-tight zero-G work surface, some wrapped pieces of roast beef that must have come from the ship, bulbs of mustard, and several tankards of Tian Shan rice beer. Suddenly, I was starved. The sandwiches were large and thick. She set them on catch plates made of some strong fiber, lifted her own meal and a beer bulb, and kicked toward the outer wall. A portal appeared and began to iris open.
"Ah," I said alertly, meaning, "excuse me, Ania, but that's space out there. Aren't we both going to explosively decompress and die horribly?"
She kicked out through the organic portal, and I shrugged and followed. There were catwalks, suspension bridges, stick-tight stairways, balconies and terraces out there, made of steel-hard plant fiber and winding around the pods, stalks, branches, and trunks like so much ivy. There was also air to breathe. It smelled of a forest after a rain.
"Containment field," I said, thinking that I should have expected this. After all, if the consul's ancient starship could have a balcony... I looked around.
"What powers it?" I said. "Solar receptors?"
"Indirectly," said Ania, finding us a stick-tight bench and mat. There were no railings on this tiny, intricately woven balcony. The huge branch, at least 30 meters across, ended in a profusion of leaves above us, and the latticework web of the trunks and branches beneath us convinced my inner ear that we were many kilometers up on a wall made of crisscrossed green girders. I resisted the urge to throw myself down on the stick-tight mat and cling for dear life. A radiant gossamer fluttered by, followed by some type of small bird with a V-shaped tail.
"Indirectly," I said, my mouth full as I took a huge bite of sandwich.
"The sunlight, for the most part, is converted to containment fields by ergs," continued my friend, sipping her beer and looking out at the seemingly infinite expanse of leaves above us, below us, to all sides of us, their green faces all turned toward the brilliant star. There was not enough air to give us a blue sky, but the containment field polarized the view toward the sun just enough to keep us from being blinded when we glanced that direction. I almost spit my food out, managed to swallow instead, and said,
Ergs? As in Aldebaran energy binders? You were serious? Ergs like the one taken on the last Hyperion pilgrimage?
Yes, said Anea.
Her dark eyes were focused on me now. I thought they were extinct.
Nope, said Anea.
I took a long drink from the beer bulb and shook my head. I'm confused.
You have a right to be, my dear friend, Anea said softly.
This place. I made a weak gesture toward the wall of branches and leaves, trailing away so much farther than a planetary horizon. The infinitely distant curve of green and black far above us. It's impossible, I said.
Not quite, said Anea.
The Templars and Austers have been working on it, and others like it, for 1,000 years. I began chewing again. The cheese and roast beef were delicious. So this is where the thousands and millions of trees went when they abandoned God's Grove during the fall.
Some of them, said Anea.
But the Templars had been working with the Austers to develop orbital forest rings and biospheres long before that. I peered up. The distances made me dizzy. The sense of being on this small leafy platform, so many kilometers above nothing, made me reel. Far below us and to our right, something that looked like a tiny green sprig moved slowly between the latticed branches. I saw the film of energy field around it and realized that I was looking at one of the fabled Templar tree ships, almost certainly kilometers long.
Is this finished, then? I said.
A true Dyson sphere, a globe around a star? Anea shook her head.
Far from it.
Although about 20 standard years ago, they made contact with all the primary trunk tendrils. Technically, it's a sphere, but most of it is comprised of holes at this point, some many millions of clicks across.
Fan-fucking-tastic, I said, realizing that I could have been more eloquent.
I rubbed my cheeks, feeling the heavy growth of beard there.
I've been out of it for 2 weeks, I said.
15 standard days, said Anea.
Usually the dock in the box works more quickly than that, I said. I finished the sandwich, stuck the catch plate to the table surface, and concentrated on the beer.
Usually it does, agreed Anea. Rachel must have told you that you spent a relatively short time in the autosurgeon. She did most of the initial surgery herself.
Why? I said.
The box was full, said Anea. We defrosted you from fugue as soon as we got here, but the three in the dock ahead of you were in bad shape. DeSoya was near death for a full week. The sergeant, Gregorius, was much more seriously injured than he had let on when we met him on the Great Peak. And the third officer, Carol Sean, died, despite the box's and the ouster medic's best efforts.
Shit, I said, lowering the beer. I'm sorry to hear that. One got used to autosurgeons fixing almost anything.
Anea looked at me with such intensity that I could feel her gaze warming my skin as surely as I could feel the powerful sunlight. How are you, Rawl?
Great, I said. I ache a bit. I can feel the healing ribs, the scars itch, and I feel like I overslept by 2 weeks, but I feel good. She took my hand. I realized that her eyes were moist.
I would have been really pissed if you died on me, she said after a moment, her voice thick.
Me too. I squeezed her hand, looked up, and suddenly leaped to my feet, sending the beer bulb spiraling off into thin air and almost launching myself. Only the stick-tight Velcro soles on my soft shoes kept me anchored.
Holy shit, I said, pointing.
From this distance, it looked like a squid, perhaps only a meter or two long. From experience and a growing sense of perspective here, I knew better.
One of the Zeppelins, said Anea. The Acaratelae have tens of thousands working on the biosphere. They stay inside the CO2 and O2 envelopes.
It's not going to eat me again, is it? I said. Anea grinned.
I doubt it. The one that got a taste of you has probably spread the word.
I looked for my beer, saw the bulb tumbling away 100 meters below us, considered leaping after it, thought better of it, and sat down on the stick-tight bench. Anea gave me her bulb.
Go ahead. I can never finish those things.
She watched me drink.
Any other questions while we're talking?
I swallowed and made a dismissive gesture. Well, there happens to be a bunch of extinct, mythical, and dead people around. Care to explain that?
By extinct, you mean the Zeppelins, Sinestri, and Templars? She said.
Yeah, and the Urgs, although I haven't seen one of those yet.
The Templars and Ousters have been working to preserve such hunted sentient species, the way the colonists on Maui Covenant tried to save the old Earth dolphins, she said. From the early Hegira colonists, then the Hegemony, and now the Pax.
And the mythical and dead people, I said.
By that you mean Colonel Cassad?
And Hetmestine, I said, and for that matter Rachel. We seem to have the whole cast of the friggin' Hyperion Cantos showing up here.
Not quite, said Aenea,
her voice soft and a bit sad.
The consul is dead. Father Duray is never allowed to live. And my mother is gone.
Sorry, kiddo. She touched my hand again.
That's all right. I know what you mean. It's disconcerting.
Did you know Colonel Cassad or Hetmestine before this? I said. Aenea shook her head.
My mother told me about them, of course,
and Uncle Martin had things to add to his poem's description, but they were gone before I was born. Gone, I repeated. Don't you mean dead? I worked to remember the Cantos stanzas. According to the old poet's tale, Hetmestine, the tall Templar, the true voice of the tree, had disappeared on the wind wagon trip across Hyperion's Sea of Grass shortly after his tree ship, the Yggdrasil, had burned in orbit. Blood in the Templar's cabin suggested the Shrike. He had left behind the Urg in a Mobius cube. Sometime later, they had found Mestine in the Valley of the Time Tombs. He had not been able to explain his absence, had said only that the blood in the wind wagon had not been his, had cried out that it was his job to be the voice of the Tree of Pain, and had died. Colonel Cassad had disappeared at about that same time, shortly after entering the Valley of the Time Tombs. But the Force Colonel had, according to Martin Silenus's Cantos, followed his phantom lover, Moneta, into the far future, where he was to die in combat with the Shrike. I closed my eyes and recited aloud. Later, in the death carnage of the valley, Moneta and a few of the chosen warriors wounded all, torn and tossed themselves by the Shrike Horde's fury, found the body of Fedmon Cassad, still wrapped in death's embrace with the silent Shrike, lifting the warrior, carrying him, touching him with reverence born of loss and battle. They washed and tended his ravaged body, and bore him to the crystal monolith. Here the hero was laid on a bier of white marble. Weapons were set at his feet. In the valley beyond, a great bonfire filled the air with light. Human men and women carried torches through the dark, while others descended, wings soft, through morning lapis lazuli, and some others arrived in fairy craft, bubbles of light, while still others descended on wings of energy or wrapped in circles of green and gold. Later, as the stars burned in place, Moneta made her farewells to her future's friends and entered the Sphinx. Multitudes sang. Rat things poked among fallen pennants in the field where heroes fell, while the wind whispered among carapace and blade, steel and thorn. And thus, in the valley, the great tombs shimmered, faded from gold to bronze, and started their long voyage back.
Impressive memory, said Aenea.
Grandam used to cuff me if I screwed it up, I said. Don't change the subject. The Templar and the Colonel sound dead to me.
And so they will be, said Aenea. And so shall we all.
I waited for her to shift out of her Delphic phase.
The Cantos say that Hetmestine was carried away somewhere, some when by the Shrike, she said. He later died in the Valley of the Time Tombs after returning. The poem did not say if he was gone an hour or 30 years. Uncle Martin did not know.
I squinted at her. What about Cassad, kiddo? The Cantos are fairly specific there. The Colonel follows Moneta into the far future, engages in a battle with the Shrike.
With legions of Shrikes, actually, corrected my friend.
Yeah,
I said. I had never really understood that. But it seems continuous enough. He follows her, he fights, he dies. His body is put in the crystal monolith, and it and Moneta begin the long trip back through time. Aenea nodded and smiled.
With the Shrike, she said.
I paused. The Shrike had emerged from the tombs. Moneta had traveled with it somehow. So although the Kantos clearly said that Kassad had destroyed the Shrike in that great final battle, the monster was somehow alive and traveling with Moneta and Kassad's body back through... Damn. Did the poem ever actually say that Kassad was dead?
Uncle Martin had to fake parts of the tale, you know, said Aenea. He had some descriptions from Rachel, but he took poetic license on the parts he did not understand.
Uh-huh, I said.
Rachel.
Moneta. The Kantos had clearly suggested that the girl child Rachel, who went forward with her father Saul to the future, would return as the woman Moneta, Colonel Kassad's phantom lover, the woman he would follow into the future to his fate. And what had Rachel said to me a few hours earlier, when I was suspicious that she and Aenea were lovers? I happened to be involved with a certain soldier, male, whom you'll meet today. Well, actually, I will be involved with him someday. I mean, shit, it's complicated.
Indeed. My head hurt.
I set down the beer bulb and held my head in my hands.
It's more complicated than that, said Aenea.
I peered up at her through my fingers. Care to explain?
Yes, but...
I know, I said, at some other time.
Yes, said Aenea,
her hand on mine. Any reason why we can't talk about it now? I said.
Aenea nodded. We have to go in our pod now and opaque the walls, she said.
We do? I said.
Yes.
And then what? I said.
Then, said Aenea,
floating free of the stick-tight mat and pulling me with her.
We make love. For hours.
Chapter 25 Zero G. Weightlessness. I had never really appreciated those terms and that reality before. Our living pod was opaqued to the point that the rich evening light glowed as if through thick parchment. Once again, I had the impression of being in a warm heart. Once again, I realized how much Aenea was in my heart. At first, the encounter bordered on the clinical, as Aenea carefully removed my clothes and expected the healing surgical scars, gently touched my repaired ribs, and ran her palm down my back.
I should shave, I said, and shower.
Nonsense, whispered my friend. I've given you sponge and sonic baths every day, including this morning. You're perfectly clean, my dear, and I like the whiskers.
She moved her fingers across my cheek.
We floated above the soft and rounded cubby shelves. I helped Aenea out of her shirt, trousers, and underwear. As each piece came clear, she kicked it through the air into the cubby drawer, shutting the fiber panel with her bare foot when everything was inside. We both chuckled. My own clothes were still floating in the quiet air, the sleeves of my shirt gesturing in slow motion.
I'll get the... I began.
No, you won't, said Aenea, and pulled me closer.
Even kissing demands new skills in zero-G. Aenea's hair coiled around her head in a sunlit corona as I held her face in my hands and kissed her. Her lips, eyes, cheeks, forehead, and lips again. We began tumbling slowly, brushing the smooth and glowing wall. It was as warm as my dear friend's flesh. One of us pushed off and we tumbled together into the middle of the oval pod space. Our kissing became more urgent. Each time we moved to hold the other more tightly, we would begin to pivot around an invisible center of mass. Arms and legs entangled as we pressed tighter and rotated more quickly. Without disentangling or interrupting our kiss, I held out one arm,
waited for the flesh-warm walls to reach us and stopped our tumble. The contact pushed us away from the curved, warmly glowing wall and sent us spinning very slowly toward the center again. Anea broke our kiss and moved her head back a moment, still holding my arms, regarding me from arm's length. I had seen her smile 10,000 times in the last 10 years of her life, had thought that I knew all of her smiles. But this one was deeper, older, more mysterious, and more mischievous than any I had seen before. "Don't move," she whispered, and pushing softly against my arm for leverage, rotated in space. "Anea," was all I could say. And then I could say nothing. I closed my eyes, oblivious of everything except sensation. I could feel my darling's hands tight on the backs of my legs, pulling me closer to her. After a moment, her knees came to rest against my shoulders, her thighs bumping softly against my chest. I reached out to the hollow of her back and pulled her closer, sliding my cheek along the strong muscle of her inner thigh. At Taliesin West, one of the cooks had owned a tabby cat. Many evenings when I was sitting alone out on the western terrace, watching the sunset and feeling the stones lose their day's heat, waiting for the hour when Anea and I could sit in her shelter and talk about everything and nothing, I would watch the cat lap slowly from her bowl of cream. I visualized that cat now, but within minutes I could visualize nothing but the immediate and overpowering sense of my dear friend opening to me. Of the subtle taste of the sea, of our movements like the tide rising, of all of my senses being centered in the slow but growing sensation at the core of me. How long we floated this way, I have no idea. Such overwhelming excitement is like a fire that consumes time. Total intimacy is an exemption from the space-time demands of the universe. Only the growing prerogatives of our passion and the ineluctable need to be even closer than this penultimate closeness marked the minutes of our lovemaking. Anea opened her legs wider, moved away, released me with her mouth but not her hand. We pivoted again in the sepia light. Her tight fingers and my excitement, the center of our slow rotation. We kissed, lips moist, Anea's grasp tightening around me. "Now," she whispered. I obeyed. If there is a true secret to the universe, it is this. These first few seconds of warmth and entry and complete acceptance by one's beloved. We kissed again, oblivious of our slow tumbling, the rich light taking on a heart warmth around us. I opened my eyes long enough to see Anea's hair swirling like Ophelia's cloak in the wine-dark sea of air in which we floated. It was indeed like holding my beloved in deep salty water, buoyed up and weightless, the warmth of her around me like the rising tide, our movements as regular as the surf against warm sand. "Oops," whispered Anea, after only a moment of this perfection. I paused in my kissing long enough to assess what was separating us. "Newton's law," I whispered against her cheek. "For every action," whispered Anea, chuckling softly, holding my shoulders like a swimmer pausing to rest. "An equal and opposite reaction," I said, smiling until she kissed me again. "Solution," whispered Anea. Her legs closed tight around my hips, her breasts floated between us, the nipples teasing my chest. Then she lay back, again the swimmer, floating this time, her arms spread but her fingers still interlaced with mine. We continued to pivot slowly around our common center of gravity, a slow tumble, my head coming over and down and around like a rider on a porpoise doing slow cartwheels in the sunlit depths. But I was no longer interested or aware of the elegant ballistics of our lovemaking, but only in the lovemaking. We moved faster in the warm sea of air. Some minutes later, Ania released my hands, moved upright and forward as we tumbled together, still moving, sank her short nails into my back, even while she kissed me with a wild urgency, and then moved her mouth away to gasp and cry out once softly. At the same instant as her cry, I felt the warm universe of her close around me with that short, tight throb, that intimate, shared pulse. A second later, it was my turn to gasp, to cling to her as I throbbed within her, to whisper into her salty neck and floating hair, "Ania, Ania," a prayer. My only prayer then, my only prayer now. For a long time we floated together, even after we had become two people again rather than one. Our legs were still intertwined, our fingers stroking and holding one another. I kissed her throat and felt her pulse like a memory echo against my lips. She ran her fingers through my sweaty hair. I realized that for this moment, nothing in the past mattered. Nothing terrible in the future mattered. What mattered was her skin against me, her hand holding me, the perfume of her hair and skin, and the warmth of her breath against my chest. This was Satori. This was truth. Ania kicked away to the pod cubby just long enough to return with a small, warm, and wet towel. We took turns wiping some of the sweat and slickness from us. My shirt floated by, the empty sleeves attempting to swim in the gentle air currents. Ania laughed and lingered in her washing and drying, the simple act quickly turning into something else. "Oops," said Ania, smiling at me. "How did that happen?" "Newton's law," I said. "That makes sense," she whispered. "Then what would be the reaction if I were to do this?" I think we were both surprised by the instant result of her experiment. "We have hours until we have to meet the others on the tree ship," she said softly. She said something to the living pod, and the curved wall went absolutely transparent. It was as if we were floating among these countless branches and sail-sized leaves, the sun's warmth bathing us one moment and then being submerged in night and stars when we looked out the other side of the clear pod. "Don't worry," said Ania. "We can see out, but the exterior is opaque on the outside, reflective." "How can you be sure?" I whispered, kissing her neck again, seeking the soft pulse. Ania sighed. "I guess we can't without going out to look in. Sort of a David Hume problem." I tried to remember my philosophy readings at Taliesin, recalled our discussions of Berkeley, Hume, and Kant, and chuckled. "There's another way we can check," I said, rubbing my bare feet along her calves and the back of her legs. "How's that?" murmured my friend, her eyes closed. "If anyone can see in," I said, floating behind her, rubbing her back without letting her float away. "There's going to be a huge crowd of Ouster angels and Templar tree ships and comet farmers hanging out there in about 30 minutes. "Really?" said Ania, eyes still closed. "And why is that?" I began to show her. She opened her eyes. "Oh, my," she said softly. I was afraid that I was shocking her. "Rawl," she whispered. I said, not stopping what I was doing. I closed my eyes. "Maybe you're right about the pod being reflective."